post a picture of the Zoom with like the meeting ID there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's the one.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you have a repeating ID, like all your office hours, it's a repeating ID. So basically it's one ID for the, so if you, once you get that ID, you can drop in on multiple meetings, because especially if you schedule the meetings as a recurring meeting, it's one meeting ID for all of the meetings.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay.
I didn't know that the last Friday I Zoom bombed someone. So I went onto the.
So you're the person who Zoom bombed somebody.
So it was, I got confused with the time and I thought it's an hour early. So I went in and they're like, why are you here?
Was it an NYU classes? Was it an NYU meeting service?
Yeah.
Just a regular class. That happens in at Stern in a regular class. People come in and say, oh my God, I'm in the wrong class. They get up and leave.
Yeah. I've done that.
Yeah,
that's the virtual version of that.
I'm going to start sharing my screen because we're getting close to starting time here.
Okay.
You're going to show up the screen, so don't worry.
Do you have everyone's score now?
Do I have everyone's score? If you've taken the quiz, otherwise I don't. So, yeah. I should, though I was told that Shashanka told me that I'm corporate finance scores haven't shown up in your grade book because they should show up almost instantaneously. So I'll check to see what's going on because it might be that there's a delay in lagging, but it's, the scores have already been recorded because the computer grades instantaneously. It's more efficient than I could ever be. So that's.
Well, can we see them?
Can I see them?
Can we see them? I didn't know we can see them. I'm gonna.
You should be able to see it in your gradebook. You'll get the full feedback, I think, by this evening. On each problem, you get the right solution, and you basically be able to see whether it's zero. It's either you get the points or you don't. So you'll see the solution. So, but you should usually be able to see it in the gradebook. But as I said, Shashanka said you can't see it in the gradebook for this particular class. You can for the other class. So let me see what's going on after the class is over. One of the problems is if I go into the test right now, I did this with my undergraduate class and I tried to do something, it actually pulls the test from everybody taking the test at that time, which freaks people out because you're sitting there taking the test and suddenly the test disappears. Now it freaked people out because they lost the test for like 2 minutes. I'm wary of doing anything while the test is being taken, but I'll fix it as soon as it's done.
Yeah, I was just going to say I wasn't able to see the grade either. So maybe it's.
But your case and your first quiz are in there, right?
Yes.
Okay. I'll check. It might be that it's not transmitting the scores yet, but it should. I'll wait till 2 o'clock, which is when the quiz is scheduled to end. And right after 2 o'clock New York time. Check your grade book and you should be able to see your score and you should get the full feedback by later tonight.
Sure, thank you. Professor Damodaran, will our final exam be also along these lines?
Yeah. There's no physical way to otherwise do it, right? If I did a quiz, then imagine sending me your PDF files and it'll be a complete nightmare. So unfortunately, with online classes, it's very difficult, especially with a large class, to be able to do the things you could have done in the classroom. So, yeah. Okay, folks, I think we're all here, as many as I am, and thank you for joining in. I know it's a quiz day and you don't feel like doing more corporate finance, but you know what? I'm going to do, as I said, I'm going to stick to the script, because if this were regular class, we'd be having class after the quiz. So just as you hated it then in its physical format, you might not like it now online, but let's keep going, because we're going to wrap up packet one today. So in the last session, we were talking about side costs, right? We were talking about opportunity costs and how when you use a resource you already own as a company, you have to think through the costs of using those resources. Otherwise, what you have are projects get taken because you have a couple of engineers who have extra time, you have a warehouse that's free, and before you know it, you're tying up resources for the long term. So we talked about costing out resources that you already own. That costing out can either be what you could make by selling the resource. So if you have a warehouse that's empty, you could sell it, by renting the warehouse. Out of the most messy case where you're not planning to rent or sell it, but by using that excess capacity now. Think studio in the Netflix Fit example, you're running out of capacity sooner. So it's all about opportunity costs. And the way this shows up is once you've computed that opportunity cost and brought it into your cash flows, your net present value reflects the fact that you're using resources. Any questions about project side costs? Okay, so let's talk about project synergies. What are project synergies? When you take a project, sometimes you get side benefits for other projects. I mean, I'll take Disney's a perfect example of this, right? When my son works in Disney Consumer Products, and one of his jobs is before a movie comes out is to think about the consumer products that come out of the movie, Onward, the Pixar movie that came out. Now you had to think about what toys, what merchandise, what games you can make out of it, and think about ways in which you can convert that into revenues and cash flows. In the case of Disney, it's also the fact that you have theme parks. If you've read the news, you know that in both Disneyland and Disney World, they've introduced a portion of the theme park that's Star Wars focused. It's a huge hit. So those side benefits are often a factor in whether you take the project. So if you ask me to evaluate a Disney movie then, it's not just the gate receipts I should be thinking about, it's all these synergies. I can see that. But you can't just talk about the synergies. You got to bring them into the cash flows. Remember, we said there's no garnishing in investment analysis, and you have to incorporate them in your net present value. So what I'll do is look at two examples. The first is, remember that online bookstore that Bookscape was planning to introduce? Let's assume that by having that online bookstore, and again, this example is dated, you're going to laugh at the prospect of people actually going to a physical bookstore. Let's assume that by creating that online, that Bookscape is going to put a cafe in one of these bookstores. Let's assume that the cafe by itself has a negative net present value. Let me give it a big negative net present value, -88,000. So by itself, the cafe is bad. You're saying, I don't want to open the cafe. But then I add a plus. I say, if you open the cafe, people who come into the cafe are more likely to buy books. And because they buy more books, your revenues will increase by 500,000 next year. And that 500,000 will grow at 50% for the next 3 years. So I give you the revenues, I give you the margins, and I say, here are my the income I'm going to generate from those additional revenues. I've created a side benefit, right? But that side benefit has been quantified. I discount those side benefits back at the cost of capital for bookstores. Why? Because the side benefits come to the bookstore. The cafe might be creating the side benefits, but the side benefits come to the bookstore. That net present value that I get from the side benefits is $135,000. You compare it, you incorporate that into your analysis. Your cafe standing alone had a -87,571 net present value, but the side benefits exceed that net present value. So your fully incorporated net present value is positive. So guess what? You're going to open the bookstore. And open the cafe. The reason you're going to open the cafe is the full net present value with the side benefits brought in is now positive. Any questions on that example? So that's again, if you want to think in terms of I hate to draw you back to the case of Netflix Fit, one additional side benefit there was what Netflix Entertainment got as additional revenues. And you brought that into the analysis. And there, again, as I said, the right thing to do is to use the cost of capital for the business that gets a benefit. But in the case of Netflix, again, I said, it doesn't matter that much if you use the other cost of capital. But the right thing always is to use the discount rate that reflects the risk of those cash flows. No questions on the cafe example? Okay, so let's talk about that merger that we looked at. Remember Tata Motors approached Harman International and wanted to acquire it. And we came up with a value of $2,476 million for Harman as a standalone company. And I'll remind you how we did that. We said Harman is a US-based company and you're going to do the valuation in US dollars. We projected the cash flows for Harman in US dollars. We discounted those cash flows at a dollar cost of capital, which reflected Harman's risk as a company. And we came up with a value of $2,476 million. That was well below the market cap, which was in excess of $5 billion. And I said, based on that, you shouldn't do the deal. But then I said, wait, there might be synergies. Now, let me be explicit about the synergies that this particular merger is going to create. Again, if I say the word synergy, I've got to follow through and give you the specifics of the synergy. Let's say Tata plans to incorporate Harman's technology into its cars. So it's going to bring in high-end audio into Tata cars. It's going to take Tata about 3 years to incorporate. So it's not going to be overnight. Again, we've got to be realistic. Even when there's synergy in a merger, it's not going to often show up instantaneously. In this case, you've got to wait 3 years. You're saying, who cares? Hey, time, has value, right? There's a time value of money. We're going to factor that into our synergy. And here's what's going to happen. Starting with after year three, Tata will be able to generate about 10 billion rupees in after-tax operating income on its automobile business because it's going to be able to sell these audio upgrades to its Indian customers. That 10 billion is expected to grow 4% a year after that in perpetuity, but the synergy is going to be only in India. Now you might wonder why I'm adding all of these details, but here's why it's going to matter. When I look at the risk in these additional cash flows, the risk is going to come from me selling cars, not from selling audio systems. So I'm going to go back to the beta that I computed for Tata Motors. It's an automobile revenue, so I'm going to use that beta. I'm going to also look at where the synergies are created. And if you looked at where the synergies were created, they were created entirely in India. You're saying, why does that matter? The country risk premium that I use is entirely the Indian country risk premium. So I'm using the automobile beta. I'm using India's country risk premium. And I did say as part of the synergies that I'm going to assume that this is going to be funded at the same debt ratio as the automobile business. So I revert back almost to my automobile example. I used an automobile beta in Indian rupee risk-free rate because I'm doing my benefits in Indian rupees. And I compute an Indian rupee cost of capital of 13.63% for just the synergies. Notice again, I'm not using a dollar cost of capital. I'm not using Harman Audio's numbers. I'm using the numbers reflecting where the synergy is created. In some cases, the synergy is to both companies. So Harman Audio is benefiting as well. Then I'd use the combined company's cost of capital. But here, since the benefits come to Tata Motors on their automobile business, I'm sticking to the automobile beta. So here's what I do. I take the 10 billion rupees that I expect to make in year four. So the first step is I treat it as a perpetuity. 10 billion, growing at 4% a year, 13.63% cost of capital. The present value that I get is $103.8 billion. But that starts in year three, at the end of year three. So I then bring it back 3 years. This is the best and easiest way to deal with delayed synergy. You know what I mean by delayed synergy? If you wait 3, 5, 10 years to get the synergy, just value the synergy first, as if there were no delay, then discount it back to today using the cost of capital. And what I get as a present value is 70.75 billion rupees. I say, what do I do with this? This is the synergy from the merger. Since I've done the rest of my analysis in dollars, I converted that synergy from rupees to dollars. And because it's already in present value terms, I can use today's exchange rate of 60 rupees to dollars. Today, as in whenever I did this in 2013, I get a present value of the synergy of 1,179 million. I'm ready to put this merger to the test. By buying Harman Audio, I'm getting 2.678 billion in intrinsic value. The synergy that I get from this merger is 1,179 million. You add those two numbers together, the value that I get from this deal as Tata Motors with the synergy in there is 3,857 million. That's still lower than the 5,248 million market cap. And if I have to pay a premium on that market cap, this deal becomes a really bad deal. So many of you are going to go work at banks or companies where there will be mergers. Now remember, this the period wherein we'll pass, we're going to go back to doing deals. And you're going to do a valuation of a target company. You're going to come up with the value. And the acquiring company's managers are going to say, they're going to pay a premium. And you say, why are you paying a premium on that value? They're going to say synergy. And that's all they'll say. And you can't do that. It can't be a buzzword. If there is talk of synergy, you have to put people on the spot and ask them to be explicit. Tell me where the synergy is. It could be higher revenues, which is the case here. It could be lower costs. If you have a merger where you're going to cut costs after the merger, it could even be lower risk, though that's very unlikely because if you're looking at diversified investors, it's very difficult to create risk benefits from it. But it has to show up somewhere in your cash flows or your discount rate. Otherwise, you can't pay for it because ultimately, synergy has to show up in the cash flows or the discount rate to have that. Any questions? I know it's a very quick run at Synergy. We'll come back. If you come back from a valuation class for more punishment, we'll do this more explicitly in the valuation class. You know, but the basic structure is going to just stay the same, you know, no matter what form the Synergy takes. Any questions about Synergy? Sam asked, what's the difference between Synergy and side benefit? None. Synergy is the side benefit from mergers. But if you think about side benefits more broadly, you don't have to have it in the form of synergy. A Disney movie creates side benefits for the rest of the company. We don't call that synergy. We just call it a side benefit. Synergy is specific to mergers. So it's just a side benefit in most mergers. Any questions? Okay. So now I'm going to do a little side run. And here again, I'm going to touch this to the surface. Often when we look at projects, and if you think about how we've analyzed the projects, now we do what's called the static analysis. You know what I mean by static analysis? To decide whether to open Rio Disney, what do? We said, if I invest in Rio Disney today, what are my cash flows? What is my investment? What is my net present value? And what was the rule? If the net present value was positive, you'd accept the project was a good project. If the net present value was negative, don't take the project. And I said, that's a very simple rule. Now I'm going to give you ways of breaking this rule, but I want you to be very careful with this power I give you. In fact, I think the words that come to mind are the words from the Spider-Man movies. Anybody want to tell me what those words are? Come on, you've seen Spider-Man. With great power comes destruction.
With great power comes great responsibility.
Exactly. I'm going to give you great power because now I'm going to let you override the numbers, right? This is everybody's dream. The numbers guy comes in the numbers and you say, you know what? We're going to take this project anyway. I'm going to give you ammunition and I want you to use it carefully. Because here's what I'm going to bring in. I'm going to bring in the fact that you've done a static analysis. If you took the project today, it's a bad project, right? That's what the net present value tells you. But I'm going to bring in three potential options that might make a bad project into a good project. In other words, you might still take this project. The first is the option to delay. You know what I mean by the option to delay? You can have a project that's a bad project today, but it could become a good project in the future. So I'm gonna separate out whether a project is a good project from whether you should try to get the rights to that project. Very important option when you're talking about technologies. There are some technologies that are not viable today, but you'd still pay for the technology because that technology could become viable in the future. So I'm going to give you at least a picture of the option delay and give you a couple of examples where it might play out. The second is the option to expand. What does that mean? You might look at a project. Let's make it an explicit project. You're thinking about whether you should expand into India. You're a US company. You do the project analysis, and the project analysis says net present value is negative, don't expand into India. And then I bring up a point. I say, look, India is a very big market, and if you take this project, even though it's a negative net present value project, it might give you the right to expand into India that could be very lucrative. We can't think of what that expansion option looks like right now, but there is that big market. With big markets, sometimes you might take a bad project up front because it gives you the right to expand into that big market. Let's face it. This is often the rationale that many US companies have used to expand into China. Is China, the initial investment might be a negative net present value investment, but the fact that it's such a big market means that you might take that first project. That's the option to expand. And the third is the option to abandon. We go back to the Rio Disney theme park. It was, what, a 40-year, 50-year investment, and you took it because you thought the net present value was positive, right? But let's say 3 or 4 years into the investment, you realize that this investment is not working out. People are not coming to the Rio theme park. It's too dangerous. So you look at the project and you say, look, am I stuck with the project for the next 47 years? And the answer is no. The option to abandon gives you the right to walk away from a project if it turns out to be a really bad project. The option to delay, the option to expand, the option to abandon. All of these options add value to a project and they might allow you to override the analysis. As I said, I'm just going to give you the surface level discussion of this because you could actually come up with explicit numbers and we will do this in the valuation class, but I don't think we need to do this here. I just want you to get the intuition. Let's think about the option to expect. Before we do that though, think about what it is about an option that makes it an option. An option gives you the right to buy or sell something at a fixed price. It's a right, not an obligation. And one of the things that sets options apart is the payoff diagram for an option. The best way to identify whether you have an option is to draw a payoff diagram. You say, what are you talking about? Remember in foundations when you drew, and I know you don't, even if it was something you kind of erased from your mind, but one of the things that made options options was this kinked payoff diagram. What does a kink mean? With an option, you get limited losses when you buy an option and potentially unlimited profits. This is, for instance, the picture of a call option. If your stock price is below the strike price, you lose a fixed amount. But if it's greater than the strike price, dollar for dollar, you make profits. Whenever you have a payoff diagram that looks like that, you have a call option. Listen, why are we talking about this in the context of a project? Let's say you have the right to take a project. What does that mean? At any point in time in the next 10 years, you can take this project. And if you take the project, let's say I told you, you have to invest $1 billion. Right now, the net present value of the cash, the present value of the cash flows from taking the project might be only 800 million. Pause right there. It costs you $1 billion to take a project. You're going to make only 800 million in present value of cash flows. You're saying, I don't want that project. You're right. You don't want to take that project now. But let's say I give you the rights to this project for the next 10 years. Might you still pay for that right? It's a bad project now. Net present value is minus 200. Might you still pay for the rights to this project for the next 10 years? And why would you do it? Anybody?
Because the NPV could change with situations changing, markets changing, interest rates.
Market changing. And this is why with technology, this is the wild card, right? Today, you might say, look, this is a terrible project. It's minus 200 million. Let's say I come to you with a let's say you were IBM, and this was a year and a half ago, and I came to you with a technology exactly like Zoom's technology. But this isn't rocket science. What Zoom did, Cisco has done in WebEx. So let's say you're at IBM, and I come to you with this technology, and I came up with the cash flows, and it looked like a terrible technology. Right, in terms of present value. Let's say you paid for the rights to that technology for the next 5 years. Let's say it's a Zoom technology and you paid for the rights for the next 10 years. All you needed was a crisis where everybody's online. So one reason you might pay for a technology that's not viable is things change, markets change, technology changes. And what happens then is the present value of the cash flows jumps from 800 million to 2 billion. And all of a sudden, your non-viable technologies become viable. But be realistic though. When you go pay for these projects, you get rights to these projects and they're non-viable. Could some of them end up remaining non-viable for the remaining 10 years? Absolutely, right? That's what happens with options. I don't know whether you remember, but Qualcomm about 5 years ago sold its entire patent, I think like hundreds of patents, I don't know to whom, Cisco, Google, somebody bought the entire patent. I should look it up. But they bought a portfolio of patents. Many of these patents were not viable, and they probably stayed not viable. But all you need is some of these patents to start paying off, where you get this argument working in your favor. So the option to delay just sends a message, which is you can have a project that is non-viable today. And all that's telling you is don't take the project today. It's not telling you anything about the rights to that technology. And I'll give you a story to illustrate how critical it is that we understand that the rights to a project are not the same thing as whether you should take the project today. In the early 1970s, RCA, which was then a major US TV manufacturer, one of the leading players in the TV game, came up with the technology. You know what the technology was? It was a box-like product where you could put in a tape and you could actually watch something on your TV playing off the tape. You know what that is, right? The original VCR. And when they came up with the VCR, somebody at RCA did a present value analysis. And they concluded it was a terrible investment. And here's why. They said, who would buy for a box with a demo tape with nothing to watch? Remember, there were no VCRs. You know, there were no videotapes you could watch. There were no, you couldn't go to a Blockbuster and rent a tape. So their conclusion then was, don't make the VCR. It's not a viable product. You won't make enough money. And they were absolutely right about the net present value of producing the VCR then. But that's when RCA made its, what I think was its fatal mistake. It said the technology has a negative net present value, technology to make the VCR. But because the technology is giving a negative net present value, the rights to that technology are also worth nothing. So when Panasonic came to RCA and said, will you sell us this right? RCA thought that Panasonic was crazy. They say, you're paying for this right? And nobody, I mean, this is a negative net present value project. They sold the rights to the VCR technology for a song. And here's the ironic feature. 10 years later, of course, we were all having VCRs. RCA wanted to make VCRs. Do you know what they had to do? They had to go back to Panasonic and pay for a license to make VCRs. And they paid 10 times more per year than what they sold the technology for. I'm not suggesting that you need to hold on to every non-viable technology, but you need to think about not just is this product a good project or bad project today. That's all net present value tells you. You got to think about the rights of the project. And guess what? One of the features about options, one of the features that makes options different from traditional assets is as you increase risk, an option increases in value. It's the only asset where increasing risk increases value. So the more uncertain you're about the future, the more you need to think about the optionality before you give away the rights to that technology. So when you go, if you go and work for a technology company and you have a patent that's not viable, before you throw it away or give it away for nothing, think through what that right is worth. And it could be worth a lot, even though the basic technology is not viable. Now, let's talk about the option to expand. So here's how the option to expand works. You have a project, the net present value is negative, but you're planning to take it anyway. You're saying, why would I do it? Because it gives you the rights to a second project. So I'll give you a classic example of the option to expand. Let's say you're Marriott, and I come to you, and this is early in your, let's say it's 15 years ago. Marriott has no hotels in China. I'm working for Marriott, and I say, we should open some hotels in China. It's a big market. They say, okay, do a project analysis on opening 10 hotels. So I do my project analysis on 10 hotels and I come back with bad news. I say, if we open these 10 hotels now in China, it's still an evolving market. People don't spend a lot on hotel rooms. The net present value looks negative. You say, okay, that settles it. We shouldn't open the hotels. I say, but wait, if we open these 10 hotels, we also could potentially, and those 10 hotels do well. Remember that even when your net present value is negative, there are some scenarios where they could end up doing well and the net present value could be positive. If the net present value, if it turns out that the hotels do better than expected, we could open 100 more hotels. It's a huge market, billion people there. And that could be a hugely lucrative project. You see where my argument is going? The initial 10 hotels have a negative net present value, but if you open them, and they start to do well, then we can launch 100 more hotels because it's a big market. And the present value of those 100 hotels will be so large that they will overwhelm the negative net present value of the initial investment. So when you talk about the option expand, you have two projects. The initial project, the small introductory project, there is a negative net present value, but the potential to expand has a huge positive net present value. And therefore you take the bad project because you get the right to this lucrative project in the future. When people use the word strategic, this is often what they're talking about, right? There's a strategic imperative to be in this market. It's a big market. What I'm trying to say here, we use the word strategic. We're talking about the option to expand. We have to start thinking through more seriously that option to expand. If I worked at Marriott and I was pushing back, here's the question I would ask. I'd say, let's say we open these 10 hotels and they do really well. You know what I'm worried about? I'm not the only company watching these 10 hotels do well. So is Hilton, so is Hyatt. Just as I get ready to open 100 hotels, what if they jump the gun? I've done their test marketing for them. So the question I would have when you talk about the option to expand is, where's the exclusivity? You know what I mean by exclusivity? If only I can observe how my hotels are doing, then I get the right to expand because nobody else can see how well they're doing. If I have no exclusivity, the option to expand becomes less valuable. So when you talk about using a big market to justify making an investment today in a bad project, you've got to think through the consequences, because otherwise you're going to be taking a lot of bad projects using the argument of it's strategic, that's a big market. Any questions about the option to expand? Okay, let's talk about the option to abandon. As I said, often when you take a long project, long-term project, and it's not doing well, there's a point at which you can say, I'm walking away from the project. That's what the option to abandon is. It too is an option, but it's a put option. If you're not familiar, if you've forgotten your call and put option terminology, just go back and review foundations very quickly. But again, the key thing to remember about a put option is the payoff diagram looks like a call option in mirror image. In other words, if the stock price is higher than the strike price, you lose a fixed amount. If it's less, you make money. You're saying, where is the put option, the option to abandon? What happens is if the project cash flows drop very low, they drop below what you can make by abandoning the project. You abandon the project and you make the difference. If the present value of the cash flows exceed what you can get by abandoning the project, you hold on to the project and you continue. That's why the option to abandon is a put option. Now the implication is, I give you two long-term projects. They both have positive net present values, but they're mutually exclusive. Let's say they both have the same positive net present value. But if you take one, you can't take the other. Let's say the net present values are roughly comparable. You know how the option to abandon might come in? Let's say on one of those projects, you have flexibility. You know what I mean by flexibility? You can walk away from that project if things don't work out. I would take that project over the project where my cost structure is more rigid. So even if you never compute the option to abandon, it's good to have that capacity to walk away from your mistakes. I mean, let's face it, it's good to have that capacity in everything, right? In your personal life, it's good to have the option to abandon. You walk into a job, it's good to be able to walk away from that job without feeling tied to it. The option to abandon is just a fancy word for flexibility to walk away from your mistakes. Any questions about the option to abandon? Perry?
My question is it fair to assume that if you have an option to abandon, your cost of capital will go down?
I wouldn't call it a cost of capital. What you then have, and I'll show it how you bring it into the cash flows, it does make the project less risky to you, because what it effectively means is you're not locked in for 50 years. You get that right to walk away. And in fact, there's a way in which you can value that option. And if the value of the option to abandon actually is... So you could have a negative net present value investment, a long-term investment, but if there's an option to abandon, you might still be able to take that investment because you get the right to walk away if things don't work out. It cuts off your worst case scenarios.
Understood. Thank you.
Hi, Professor. So in how would you calculate NPV in these scenarios? Is it just a weighted average?
No, these are not NPVs. These are options. You'd actually bring in an option pricing model. That's why I didn't go into it, because it gets really messy if your option pricing is a little tricky. So what you do is you do a traditional NPV on your project. and you value the option to expand, abandon, or delay as an option. And then you look at the value of that option relative to your net present value.
But one of the inputs is volatility. And how do you
come up with... get that? Remember how we did a Monte Carlo simulation on the Rio Disney theme park?
Oh, I see.
One of the pieces of output you get from that Monte Carlo simulation is a standard deviation in your present values. That becomes the volatility in the option pricing. Okay. It's really neat, but it's really noisy. So I'll be quite honest. It works much better in abstract examples, so you can make up crap as you go along. On a real project, often understanding the intuition of why you need to think about the options is actually even more critical than putting the numbers on there.
Is a quick way of doing it like assigning probability weights and this?
You could do, in other words, when you do a Monte Carlo simulation, remember you get a tail on the distribution?
Yeah.
Okay. So when you have the option to expand, what it shows up is as a long tail. So basically the net present value for two projects can look the same in the simulation, but the one which has the strategic upside will have much longer positive tails.
Mm.
Okay. Whereas the option to expand is basically cutting off your negative tails. So think in terms of a distribution of present values. Option to abandon cuts off your worst case net present value. So it makes your net present value more skewed towards a positive. Option to expand increases your upside tails.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions in the option idea? As I said, it's really fun once you learn option pricing to bring back to it. And as I said, I don't want to do it yet in this class because I think, you know, for many of you, I'm worried. I don't want to insult your option pricing memory, but, you know, it can get really messy if you introduce option pricing and you're not still comfortable with basic option pricing because these are very messy options to add. Emily, you have a question?
Yeah, hi, Professor. Who are the counterparties we're talking about?
Well, in the case of an option expand, it's not really a counter, and that's what makes it messy. It's not a monetizable option. The option comes about from the fact that you do something that's operating that, so you actually monetize it yourself. So in the case of Marriott, if the 10 hotels do really well, you know how you monetize the option? You go open 100 more hotels. So you actually have to take an operating action to monetize the option.
So the company is the counterparty itself.
Exactly, exactly. Any other questions? Okay, so I'm going to close off this discussion by bringing in something that I don't think we talk about enough when we do capital budgeting. You know, in capital budgeting, every project looks good on paper when you take it. I'll wager that even the most horrifically bad projects in the world, there's a net present value analysis or a return on capital analysis that was done at the start that where that project looked good. Nobody consciously goes out and says, I'm going to take a bad project. I like taking bad projects. So one of the things we need to talk about is once you take a project, how do you keep track of that project? Because let's face it, things happen and good projects can turn bad because of circumstances that can be out of your control. So when you look at existing investments, there are two questions. So when you look at a company, you know, take a company like Disney, there's lots of existing projects online, right? It's got the theme parks, it's got the cruise ships, you know? And some of those investments you look at now, especially the cruise ships, Disney's probably looking and saying, what the hell are we thinking? So there are two things you can do when you look at an existing project. One is you can do a postmortem on what's happened already in the project. Why? Because you want to hold people accountable, right? Because you took that project, people estimated cash flows, and you want to see how close the actual cash flows come in. So you can look at the past and say, well, how's this project been doing relative to what we thought it would do? The second and more useful question is, what do we do next? Because as I will argue, existing projects don't have to stay as existing because you can abandon them, you can sell them, you can continue with them, and you have to decide what's best for you. So you almost have to revisit every project every year to say, what do we do about existing projects? So here's what it looks like on a timeline. Let's say you have a project that's a 10-year project. So when you initially invest in the project, these were the forecasted numbers. So you think in terms of Netflix, F0, F1, F2 are your projected cash flows. Let's say it's 2 years into your Netflix fit investment. I have actual numbers. That's what A0 and A1 are. So the actual numbers have come in. And what could be true about the first numbers? well, they could be better than expected, about what you expected, or worse than expected. The postmortem, I'm comparing A0 and A1 to F0 and F1 to see how close I got. I'm sorry. And then you're saying, I'm at the end of year one. What do I do for my remaining years? And now I make new forecasts. You're saying, why would my new forecast be different? Because I've learned from the first year of the project, things about the project, right? Maybe a lot more people are buying equipment than I thought, or a lot fewer people. So my new forecast bring in what I've learned about the project. So A0 and A1 are actual numbers. F0 through F10 were the original forecasts. NF0 through NF8 are the new updated forecasts. I know I'm introducing a lot of terminology, but here are your four choices you can have for the project. When you look at the actual numbers, and they're different from the predicted numbers, and they always will be, they can be different for two reasons. One is because of chance, right? Lots of things happen that you don't control. You made the forecast, you had no idea there was going to be the entire economy was going to get shut down. So you can't go back and punish people who took projects in January saying, how come you didn't know by April the entire economy was going to get shut down? That's chance. The other is bias. You can't do much about chance. That's why we attach a risk premium and we take risky projects, but you can do something about bias.
Did you miss his voice?
Yeah,
go ahead. Andrea? You can't hear me?
I can, sorry.
Okay, go ahead. So chance or bias can cause actuals to be different from the forecast. Now you think, how can I tell the difference? On one project, it's impossible. But let's say you've taken 100 projects in the last 10 years. If chance is the only reason for the differences between actual and forecasted numbers, when I look across the 100 projects, what should I find? Anybody? If chance is the only reason, actuals are different. A lot of variation, Sam is right, but in which direction?
It could go upwards or downwards.
Exactly, it should be random. In about half the projects, my actual should be higher than forecast. In about half the projects, it should be lower, right? Let's say I look at 100 projects, and I find that in 91 of the projects, the actuals were lower than forecast, and in only 9, the actuals are higher than forecast. What am I learning? People are biased. You know what people have found? Because people have done, they have actually done research on this. They found bias. You know in which direction?
Upward
are people biased upwards or downwards when they forecast cash flows for projects?
Upwards.
Upwards. There's a significant upward bias, and I'll tell you why. In most companies, if any of you worked at a company, who does the project analysis? You'd say it's true, it's the analyst, but usually the people pushing for the project analysis hire the analyst to do the project analysis. In other words, let's say your company is broken up into division. A division should come up with a project, and it also comes up with the forecasted numbers for the project. In other words, project advocates often are the ones projecting the cash flows for the project. See, there's going to be bias. It's natural. Chance is fixable. Because you are, over time, it's going to average out. Bias is not fixable. It's a bigger enemy. I tell companies when they design their capital budgeting processes, they cannot make bias go away. What they have to do is try to create a process where they can minimize bias. And one of the ways you can tell bias is by looking at your past projects. So any questions about postmortems? They're not doing this to punish people per se, but to get a sense of if there's bias. How you try to reduce the bias in the process. Colin asks, are there empirical rules of thumb? Actually, it turns out that senior managers have developed their own makeshift rules. You know what they do when senior managers get project numbers from a division? You know what they do before deciding on the project? Anybody know? So let's say I'm the CFO of Disney, and I get a project analysis from the movie division. They haircut the cash flows. That's exactly right, Colin. That's all they do. They take the cash flows that they get from the movie division, they knock off 20%. Why 20%? I just make up a number based on my past experience. I know it's a terrible way to deal with bias, but can you blame senior managers? Usually that's why finance groups end up being hated at companies, because it becomes the finance group's job to take all these numbers that come from all the divisions and reduce them by 20%. And everybody hates you. You're the number cruncher. But guess what? Somebody's got to draw the line on this, because otherwise we're going to be taking a lot of bad projects. So this is part of life, but I think we need to be more systematic about how we deal with bias. We can't have these haircut rules because they don't quite work. Now let's talk about what our alternatives are with existing projects. There are four things you can do with an existing project. If the present value of expected future, so now notice I've shifted into year two. I'm now looking at my new forecasts. If my present value of my forecasted cash flows are now negative, in other words, I'm looking at negative cash flows for the next 8 years, I should just shut the project down if I can, because I'll get nothing. But you know what? Nothing is better than negative cash flows. If the present value of the negative of the future cash flows is less than salvage value, I should terminate the project, sell the assets, collect the salvage value. If the present value of the future cash flows is less than what I can get by selling it to somebody else, let's say there's a bigger fool out there who's willing to pay for those cash flows, or somebody gets synergies from these, I should divest the project. But if the present value of the cash flows, even if they're lower than what I thought they would be, is greater than zero, and I cannot divest the project and I cannot salvage it, I should continue the project. Do you see what my choices are? I can liquidate, I can salvage, I can divest, I can continue. In truth, you'll be familiar. If you haven't been to Disneyland, you haven't. I actually prefer Disneyland to Disney World. It's more manageable for me. I'm sorry, I might have lost you for a minute. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take an actual project and take you through these four choices. Have you ever been to Disneyland? This is the Anaheim Disney. The old Disneyland, the original Disneyland, is basically on one side. But if you cross a walkway, and it's only like 5 minutes, you're in this park called California Adventure. California Adventure was opened in the, a while back, when in 2006, 2007. And it was opened on the expectation that it'll attract about 60% of the visitors who went to Disneyland, people Disney thought would come across, because it's so convenient, into California Adventure. And this was opened a while back, and it was opened with big expectations. $100 million in after-tax cash flows is what Disney expected would get on California Adventure. By 2008, California Adventure was not living up to expectations. It turned out that instead of 60% of people coming across, only 35 or 40% of people were coming across, partly because California Adventure was more of a grown-up theme park. It was more like a roller coaster, Six Flags kind of theme park. And a lot of people who brought their little kids to Disneyland didn't want to bring them to California Adventure. So to cut a long story short, the actual cash flows from California Adventure were running at about half what Disney thought they would be, only $50 million. So between 2001 and 2007, the actual cash flows had come in at half of expectation. So we did a postmortem on this. Of course, things have come in at lower than expectation. Maybe it was bias. Maybe the people pushing California Adventure got too optimistic. Maybe it was chance. But in early 2018, Disney faced three choices. They could shut down California Adventure, but they, and get whatever they could. And remember, sitting on pretty valuable real estate. So let's say they could make $500 million back if they shut it down. They could continue with the status quo and make $50 million. $50 million is not negative, it's still positive for the remaining life. Let's say that's a perpetuity. Or they could invest another $600 million. You say, that's terrible. Why would I throw good money after bad? Well, if you invest another $600 million and bring in more kid-type rides in there, you expect to increase the number of people crossing over and coming to the theme park from 40 to 60%, which will increase the cash flows from 50 to 80 million. So three choices. You can shut it down and make $500 million. You can continue with the status quo and make $50 million a year for growing at the inflation rate in perpetuity. Or you can invest more, $600 million, and increase the number of people coming across and increase your cash flows from 50 to 80 million. Ready? Here are the three choices. One is you can continue operations. If you continue operations, what's the value of the theme park? Well, it's $50 million growing at the inflation rate, which is 2% in 2013. Discounted back at the 6.62% theme park cost of capital is $1.1 billion. So continuing the theme park the theme park is worth 1.1 billion. You can abandon theme park and get 500 million. Already you can see you'd rather continue the theme park than abandon it because 1.1 billion is greater than half a billion. But there's a third option, right? You can invest another 600 million. If you invest another 600 million, you can get $30 million more in additional cash flows. And you can take the present value of the 30 million, growing at 2% a year, you get a present value of cash flows of 662 million. So basically, that's a net present value of 62 million. That's on top of the 1.1 billion. So your three choices is do nothing, continue with the theme park as is, make 1.1 billion, abandon the theme park and make a half a billion, or invest an extra 600 million and increase the present value from 1.1 billion to 1.16 billion. And you know what? I should invest the extra 600 million. It seems like it's bad money after good, but it actually has the highest present value. And guess which one Disney took? Anybody know? What did they decide to do in 2008? They invested another $1 billion. In fact, they now have another $1.5 billion invested into California Adventure. They have the cars section. They have the, I mean, it's a very different theme park than the one that I visited 2001 or 2002. It's now more kid friendly. It's more than breaking even for Disney. But essentially what I want you to be clear about is the choices and why I picked the one that I did. So any questions about the mechanics of the choices?
I suppose one thing, Professor, is the original investment would have had some forecast that would have justified going in, and then you find that it's not working out and your projections are off.
Yeah, I would hire different forecasters for the second one because the same guys are doing the, that's the bias issue. That's what you learn from the bias is maybe the wrong guys were forecasting it. So you know what? I make the Disneyland guys forecast that extra cash flow saying, this is why we need to look back at old projects. We know that it can lead to different processes being adopted on that second investment. Because you're right, you should be a little suspicious. The same guys who made you invest all that money in California Adventure are asking you to come back and invest more.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions, folks?
In this sort of scenario, with the, I guess, decision maker, CEO of, if you were to picture it, would they feel that they'd have to approach this thoughtfully? Because if they do invest that additional capital and it works out poorly, it reflects on them from destroying shareholder value. And then as an external investor, you look at them.
This is why we're a risk averse manager and you've had a project not work out. What is it that they try to do? Even if the best scenario is they should invest more and make it a better project, they'll often divest. And you know who will divest? Usually if a new CEO comes in, guess what he does? He starts divesting all the bad projects the old guys took, even though the best thing for them to do is to keep the project or to invest more. Because this way you blame is a big issue. You want to leave somebody else holding the bag. So companies often don't do the right thing when it comes to existing projects because, you know, human nature gets in the way. Yeah. You know, Rizwana asked a question, is there a way to deal with bias apart from haircutting the cash flows? Yes. Remember we talked about devil's advocates? Whenever there's a project analysis in a company, I would have a team whose job it is to take every assumption in the project and kind of push back. So as the project guys do their project pitch, I'll have the devil's advocate team do the counter project, which I mean, you're saying that's going to make life really complicated. But if I'm investing $2.5 billion in a project, I want to make sure it's right. We need to think seriously about processes where you get pushback. And you know what the biggest projects are, right? What's the project where you need the most of all the projects?
M&A. Acquisitions.
Sorry, which one?
Acquisitions,
exactly. I think acquisitions, you can't let the investment banking team present the numbers. Because why? What do investment banking teams do with the deal? They want the deal to go through. You almost have to think about processes where you push back. And unfortunately, the bigger the project, the less you think about those processes, which means you're more likely to take a big bad project than a small bad project. Very counterintuitive, but exactly what happens in the real world. While I'm on that, I was just thinking about Disney, and I was thinking about how horrific that Fox acquisition is turning out to be as a mistake for Disney now, right? Because they spent $74 billion. Because right now, if they hadn't spent that $74 billion, they wouldn't have as much debt as they do. They'd have a lot more cash. You know what I'd suggest Disney do? Buy AMC. Because all the theater owners are in serious trouble now. And Disney really needs the theaters to stay alive because they could have bought AMC for $6 billion right now. That $74 billion would have been so useful right now. No? But it is unfortunately the problem that you see anytime you take a big project. I interrupted somebody. Sergio, you have a question? Colin asks, are there any particular metrics? You know what? People bend metrics for bias. So you remember you tried NPV, you tried IRR, you tried return on capital, you often got different answers. Guess which metric gets presented by a project team that's biased? Whichever metric makes them look good. Metrics can't protect you against bias because the cash flows can be screwed up. The discount rates can be messed with. So unfortunately, if there's really bad bias in the process, it's very difficult to create a metric that makes that bias go away. Any other questions? Sergio, you have a question because your mic is open, but I can't hear you. No, okay. Okay, so that's about it, folks, and thank you for getting in. But next session, as you can see, we're at the end of packet one. We'll be starting on packet two. Please download it at least digitally. I know you can, the bookstores, I would write off because I don't think the bookstore is ever going to get anything new done. So try to download the PDF file. And if you have a printer and lots of ink printed, but I would not do it if your ink is a scarce resource and you can't get a replacement ink cartridge. So just do it digitally. You can follow along with the digital version. Yeah. That's it. Any final questions before I sign off?
In terms of dealing with bias, apart from having a devil's advocate, if we assign probabilities to cash flows, and come up with an expected cash flow, could that be a measure?
Who's attaching the probabilities? The bias analyst or you are?
Okay.
Right. I mean, as long as you let the bias guy do it, I've told people, look, all that expertise and valuation often gives you is better ways of hiding bias. I can hide bias. So if you're really good at valuation or capital budgeting, you can find interesting ways to hide your bias, but people will never find it. So if you're biased, it gets very difficult to create a metric or a model that takes care of it. You need pushback that comes from a human being.
Professor, in the...
And Sam says, isn't it good to be upfront about our bias? Absolutely. But what divisional team is going to say, well, look, we're biased and we're going to give you biased numbers. The problem with bias is often when people have an agenda, they're not going to tell you their bias. You got to push back and find that out on your own. Shashanka?
Yeah. So in the Disney example, I think you said the value of the project after a couple of years was around $1 billion. Is that lower than the initial investment? Yeah. Is that why that's the problem? Or?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And even if it hadn't been lower, let's say it's just lower, you still face that choice, right? My suggestion to companies is almost like zero base, which means every existing project you should be doing a year-by-year assessment because you're learning stuff about yourself. And you're learning stuff about what you should do in the future. So I would do this on every project, but especially on large projects. Hmm.
So even if it's lower than your expectation, it might still be higher than your...
Higher, I would still do it, right? Because if it's higher, it might give me ideas about how can I make this a bigger project or a better project even. What can I learn from this? There's learning that's involved here that is very useful for every company.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, folks, I'm going to sign off and I will see you on Wednesday. Take care and... have a good day.